Miller House meeting, Monday afternoon, 22nd of September, 1975. This morning, we started our meditation meeting by considering for a few minutes a very important fact. Every single thought, feeling, word, and action registers an impression upon the whole psychophysical organism, the living person. And this impression is a force which continues to work itself out. That is why no man in himself can ever escape the consequences of his total living process within himself. In the living of the religious life, it is very important for us to be free of any unworked out forces in our system. Every impression that comes should receive immediate attention as completely as possible, so that the thought or feeling or the action does not leave over a part of it which is not completely attended to. It is this which forms the stuff of what Jung called our personal unconscious. In India, for the last 40 centuries at least, we have called this the vasanas, the unworked out impressions, the good ones as well as the evil ones. Now these unworked out impressions are a sort of a debt which we accumulate. And we have to be free of that debt. And the freedom comes if and when we learn how to be totally attentive from every single moment of our life to the next moment. It is this total attentiveness which works out everything inside our own psyche, our own mind. We may compare this activity of attentiveness in the realm of the mind to the action of the various digestive juices in the body, the saliva, the gastric juice, and all the other juices which are concerned with our bodily living process, act upon the food which we eat and completely transform it. Part of it is assimilated because that is necessary for bodily living. Part of it is rejected, which is also necessary for bodily living. But the transformation has to be a complete transformation. Then the body is healthy. Now it's the same with the mind. If we are constantly and totally mindful, all the psychical and mental food, so to say, the impressions, the thoughts, the feelings, etc., which enter our mind, is completely worked out. And there is nothing left over to constipate the mind, to make the mind diseased. What is left over, what is not fully worked out, becomes neurosis, psychosis, and so on. So you see, there is this extraordinary law of the functioning of the mind, which is somewhat similar to the functioning of the body. There are, of course, differences, as you remember we saw this morning, that whereas with the body, a physical, substantial body, there are different organs for different purposes, liver, kidneys, heart, lungs, and so on, the mind is a whole thing. There are no separate organs of the mind. One situated in one part of the mind and another situated in another part of the mind. Because what we call the mind is spaceless. It is timeless. It is not matter. It is not a substance. So, the mind functions as a whole. If we experience fear, it is due to the fact that the whole mind is in the state of fear. If we experience joy, the whole mind at that moment is in the state of joy. Now, you may say, yes, but surely sometimes you have different feelings all at once. You don't actually. They alternate with great rapidity. You see, like on a cinema film, you get quickly moving, flickering colors or lights at great speed. But they make an impression and you think that you are frightened and also not frightened at the same time. But that is not the case. The whole mind registers it as such. There are no separate organs or separate parts of the mind. This we must remember. So now, when there is complete attention, the whole mind undergoes this process of transformation and it becomes purified, which is our great objective in the living of the religious life. Relate this to what the teachers have taught about the moralities. You know the commandments in the Bible, the Old Testament, the Ten Commandments. You know what Jesus said in addition. He said, you have heard it said that thou shalt not kill. But he points out that even if you think of killing somebody, you have already killed him in your imagination. He that looketh upon a woman with lust in his heart hath already committed adultery with her. So that in thought and feeling, in word and in action, all the commandments have to be obeyed, have to be carried out diligently. Now this cannot be done unless we are completely awake to what is going on in the mind and totally attentive to it. With action, you can control the action before you do it. You have an urge to do something, right? You can say, no, that is not right, that is not good, I won't do it. And you can refrain from the action. But with thought and feeling, it's different. the thought and feeling arises at once, and you are conscious of it afterwards. You are conscious of your desire to perform an action comes before you perform the action. Whereas with feeling and with thought, it doesn't come before. You are conscious after the feeling, the thought has arisen, and you say, oh, I am feeling angry or hateful, or I am feeling kind or generous, and so on. This is the difference. Now the point is that in order, therefore, to be able to be rightly attentive, you have to practice all day, every day, with great intensity, great earnestness, and you will find that the time will come when you will naturally be awake, and the feeling or the thought, which is an ill feeling or an ill thought, will not arise at all. In other words, you will have ceased to react like a machine, like an automaton, to the external stimulus. Then the mind is healthy, and there is the chance of maturity. Now, a question arises. How is it possible, in our modern life, with so many disturbances, so many things to do, all at once crowding in upon us, how can we be totally attentive and fulfill everything? The question is a very good question, and it is a truly serious difficulty. What we have to bear in mind is this. We say, I have only 1 minute to attend to this, or we may have 1 hour to attend to it. And we say to ourselves, I can't attend to it fully in 1 minute. But now, we have to be careful and understand exactly what is meant by full attentiveness. All right, we have only 1 minute. During that 1 minute, give it the fullest possible attention. That is all. Then you have to put it aside, because there are so many other things to be done physically. To the very next thing, give your full attention, and don't let your mind go back, oh, what about that thing of the previous minute, which I haven't fully attended to. Let that be completely out of your mind, and give full attention to the next thing, which may last 5 minutes, or half an hour, or whatever it is. But whilst you have the time, what time you have available for it, give your full attention during that time. And that is all you need to do. So you see, this power of total attentiveness is rightly cultivated. Now, the working out of the thought, the feeling, the full transformation of it depends upon the intensity of the attention. Don't think in terms like this, that, oh, I'll attend to it intensely and discover what to do afterwards. That is not necessary at all. In the act of total attention, you may find that some physical action is also necessary. If you are totally attentive, the physical action will follow. It will be, or rather, it will go together with the attentiveness. This is what we have to bear in mind. Now, when a person disciplines the mind in this manner, so many unnecessary actions are ruled out. Just think, in our daily life, how many unnecessary things we do and say. Especially say, usually out of every 100 words we say, 90, and in some cases perhaps 99, are quite useless. utterly useless verbiage. Man is the one animal who is totally incapable of keeping his mouth shut. The answer, perhaps, to a question is simply yes or no. All that is necessary is thank you. A long speech is not required. You see? But if one is really awake and attentive and sensible, you become sensible that way, then the necessary word alone is spoken. And that's quite enough. And similarly with action. Only the necessary action is there. You know how a great artist has this wonderful power of economy of resource. For example, in music, you take great composers like Bach or Beethoven or whoever it is, and there is just a simple little theme. And look what magic is made out of that simple little theme. You don't want a long, wonderful, complicated tune and marvelous counterpoint and everything to it, lots of tunes. No, just a simple little theme. And out of that sheer magic comes out. Look at the last quartets of Beethoven as a wonderful example of that. The works of Mozart. The way that craftsmanship with a simple theme, just a little turn of a phrase, and lo and behold, out of it comes this mighty river of melody and beauty. Or take a dramatist like Shakespeare. Take, for instance, the tragedy of Othello. Shakespeare doesn't need to work up a terrible situation on a big scale. What does the tragedy depend upon? Just a simple thing. Desdemona drops a handkerchief and the wrong man picks it up and hands it back to her. And Iago, the villain of the piece, utilizes this simple fact of a dropped handkerchief picked up by a young man and given to Desdemona. And he rouses up, Iago rouses up Othello's jealousy and he murders her. See how the whole tragedy is worked up from a simple little theme like that. Economy of resource. So by attentiveness, we develop economy of resource within ourselves. And this is essential for the spiritual life. For the nature of the spirit itself is complete economy of energy. The spirit is just one thing, not a million things. It's just one thing. It's like that. So now, this complete attentiveness completely transforms the mind. We have a teaching in India: what a man thinks upon, that he becomes. We can take worldly examples. If a man thinks, oh, I want to become a millionaire. Granted that he has certain abilities, he is likely to become a millionaire. He is thinking upon it all the time. So he becomes a millionaire. Man wants to found a great society. All right. If he has the necessary abilities and the circumstance helps him, all right, he does that. What a man thinks upon, that he becomes. But this teaching in India does not refer to such things. The teaching goes on, what a man thinketh upon, that he becomes. Therefore, think upon Brahman. Now, Brahman is the word which stands for the ultimate reality, the supreme ultimate power which out of which the universe emerges. And Brahman is the all-inclusive totality, the one total reality. Now, obviously, if you or I start thinking upon Brahman in the sense that the worldly man thinks, I will become this, that or the other, you see, that is his own ego expanding, you or I will never become the one total reality. We are limited creatures. We are born, we live and we'll die. You see, what is the meaning in this context of thinking upon Brahman? Now, you can guess. Pay total attention to Brahman. When you pay total attention, there is no self-consciousness. Nothing which says, I am paying attention to you. In total attention, you have given yourself completely, an entire self-surrender, in transcendent love. That is total attentiveness. Now, when you have given yourself like that to the Supreme Reality, and you are totally attentive to it, then you are in communion with it. You are in perfect unity with it. Now, when I say one total reality, do not imagine you can give your attention to the one total reality in terms of size. Not at all. It means that you give your total attention to whatever there is at the moment calling for attention. See, this factor of attentiveness is the key secret of the whole of the spiritual life and the religious discipline. This establishment of the complete relationship with reality and maintaining it. All right. Now, with this sort of total attentiveness, intense attentiveness, whatsoever rises up in one's own mind becomes utterly purified. And in the purification, the particular idea or thought or form just dissolves away. A new one will of course take its place, simply because it is the nature of the mind to throw out ideas and so forth, but never cling to them, never grasp at them. Take again the analogy of food. If you wish your meat and your potatoes and what not to remain meat and potatoes inside you, you will soon be ill, thoroughly ill. They must be completely transformed. Isn't that so? Then you take in more when the right time comes, and the process goes on. And therefore you live healthily. It's the same with the mind, it's the same with the spirit. The spirit and the mind and the body then are in a perfect harmony, like all three notes of a chord played together perfectly. Then you've got a beautiful chord. That's how it is. Again, with total attentiveness, something of great importance comes into being. Have you ever watched your own mental process? Say you are thinking of something, or reading something, or studying something, or, as now, you are listening to someone speaking. As I speak, does not the mind hark back to, oh, so and so said the same thing? Or no, somebody said something quite contrary to that. I wonder what is the truth. So you see, you're not totally listening. Or you say, yes, that's right, I agree with it, because you already know it. And because you know it and believe it, and then hear me say it, therefore it must be true. But is it? You see? Or you may say, ah, he's saying this. Now I wonder what will happen in the future if, according to what he says, this, that and the other might happen. So you see, the attention isn't complete and total. Listen completely, and you'll find extraordinary things happen then. The past will no longer affect you. The past is the known. It is over. It is finished. It is not dead, as we commonly say, because the whole of the past is alive in the immediate moment. What is this immediate moment? Just this very moment here, this room, this country, this planet, this world, is the result of the total past at every single living moment. So in that sense, the total past is living now, but in a transformed condition, because changes have taken place, haven't they? All these forces have played with each other, all the shapes and the substances and everything has undergone change in the process of time and movement, and at this instant, the entire past lives now. The now is the living moment of eternity. This is very important. If then you attend completely, you have transcended the limitations of time. You are not bound in the prison house of past memories, of past sorrows, or the nostalgic looking back to, ah, that was a wonderful occasion and I wish it could be here now. But it is here now in the present form, not in that form, but we cling to the dead shapes of the past, and that causes us sorrow and regret. Ah, if I was only 20 years old now, how nice it would be. All the rest of that immature rubbish. If we are men, we stand on our own feet. Here, now, we are living. The now is the immediate living moment, embodying the past, and also, this is very important, embodying what we call the future. In the immediate moment, the future has no particular shape yet, no particular manifestation yet, but it is a potentiality in the present moment. The nature of the present moment is such that it could become this, that or the other, if uninterfered with. So, the potentiality in the present moment is really the embodiment of the future. But the unfolding of this potentiality, because there is a time process, because there are various forces coming to play upon it all, the shape is really unpredictable. The actual shape. You know how it is, if you're a writer, or a speaker, or a musician, or whatever you are, you have a certain idea, a germinal idea, and then as you work it out, it changes in the process of working out. Look at the notebooks of Beethoven. It's one of the finest examples. The extraordinary difference. Take the notes of the Eroica symphony particularly. That's one of the finest examples of it. And the utter transformation of quite sort of childish little ideas which come first and which do not offer much scope for development. And then, as the days and the months pass, at last it comes. And you've got that marvelous Eroica. Especially that first movement, it's sheer magic. The way it works out. That's how the magic emerges. So, when the symphony was completed, the future, which was potential in the first idea, now had come to fulfillment. Now it's the same with us. In this immediate moment is the entire future embodied. If we are totally attentive to the immediate moment, we are in tune with that future. And this is the wonderful part of it. Our own desires do not interfere with that potentiality. What works out the potentiality? Transcendence itself works through you then. If you like to use the word God, God works through you then and inspires you. That is the person who is divinely inspired all the time. The person who is totally attentive now and therefore utterly selfless and gives himself to it. Now, his activity therefore is the same as the divine activity. It is creative activity, creative power, unhindered altogether. This is the fundamental meaning of the word karma, a word which we use in India. I expect all of you have heard this word karma. Its root is kri, the Sanskrit kri, which means, if you look in the dictionary, to make or to do. But that is not enough. They have missed out the most important word. It is to create. Now, creation takes place in the immediate now. It is causeless. It has no consequence to it. This may sound very strange to you. We haven't time to expound the whole thing in detail. You'll find a fair amount of information in my new book when it is published next year. There's a good deal written about all this there, see? Creative action is in the immediate now, the moment of eternity. Therefore, the divine creative action is always in terms of action in eternity. And if you or I are totally attentive to that, we are completely in tune, in harmony, and in rhythm. In rhythm. I won't use the word time now, because time is associated with space and manifestation. But we are in rhythm. We are thrilling in harmony with that divine creative activity. And then whatsoever happens in our life, if we live like that, is the best possible thing that can happen. It has no interference from our own desire or our own ambitions, and so forth. And so we are in the state where we do no harm to anybody or anything. Does not that mean fulfilling love? The state in which no harm is done, there is no possessiveness, there is no demand from the loved one, there is no one which is loved, but everyone and everything is loved freely and openly. In a manner that brings no harm, no impurity in that love. You see the importance of this complete attentiveness. In that state, there is no such thing as selfishness. Absolutely none. It's impossible for selfishness to be there. All right, let's go on. It is in this way, therefore, that man lives what we commonly call the holy life, the good life, in the true sense, the pure life. If I make pictures of what the holy life or the good life ought to be, I will always go wrong. You know why? Because this mind, which is at present an imperfect mind, a mind which hasn't perfect skill or knowledge, is bound to make the wrong sort of picture of what is true goodness. But if this mind is empty of all its pictures, this mind is absolutely transparent, then the light of the divine wisdom itself shines through it and guides you, the person, me, the person, into the best possible action, the pure action, which is the living of, which means living the good life, the holy life, unspoiled by my pictures of what it means. It is so important to understand this very clearly. Otherwise we say, oh, my teacher said, do this, do that, don't do this, don't do that. When I live in that way, what happens is that my natural urges, which may go against the good life, are never fully understood. In total attentiveness, everything is perfectly understood. Because with total attentiveness, you neither give way, indulge your urge, nor do you resist it, fight against it. You see, so the state of conflict is out. The state of creative action, of purification, is naturally there. And the perfect thing emerges by itself. This is very important. We all say we believe in God, we trust in God and all the rest of it, but we certainly don't live as if we trusted in God. You know that terrible saying of Oliver Cromwell in England. He told his soldiers before the battle, "Put your faith in God, but keep your powder dry." You see, this is how we are. And then we say we have faith in God. How absurd. But this total attentiveness, where oneself is not there, I have no battle to fight and win victories. I have no ambitions, no desires of my own. Then there is the divine guidance quite naturally and spontaneously. And it is everlastingly beautiful, and it is everlastingly wonderful. And this we must fully realize. Now, this total attentiveness has the power of transmuting what is actually present. That which is ill is transformed into the perfectly well. And this act of transmutation is itself bliss. The transmuting process is a blissful process. And the great agent which works in the transmutating as it takes place is death. Look, if you plant a seed in the earth, what happens? The seed as a seed no longer remains like that. If it remained a seed, there'd be no plant. The seed dies as a seed, but that death of the seed as a seed is the very means by which the plant comes into being. See, death is the actual transforming power. the transmuting power. Death is not destruction. That is why I always say this, that life, what we call eternal life in its totality, is a wonderful pulse, a creative pulse of the old teachers called it life-death. Thousands of years back, this goes back right before the days of Abraham, we have this life-death pulse. I call it the life, other life pulse. Life, new life, different life pulse. If you look at it that way, you will be free from this peculiar fear and repulsion at the idea of death. And you won't cling to what you call life. Because life is eternal. So, never be afraid to let the death process take place at the right time in the right way. It will happen by itself. And in that is marvel and beauty. Have you ever watched a leaf on a tree? Outside here, for instance, some of the leaves are ready to fall, but they don't of their own wish fall down and bring about their own death. They just wait, and the wind blows, and they go like that. And then when the wind blows a little more strongly, one leaf will naturally come out, naturally, spontaneously. And watch that leaf coming down to the ground, thrilling with ecstasy. Isn't it marvelous? This is the death of the leaf, if you like. But this is the great life process. The tree lives, and it will put forth new leaves next spring. And this leaf, which we call the dead leaf, is the giver of life to the soil, makes the soil wonderful. So you see, this appears to die, but it has become transformed into a new state, totally new state, which I, as I am now, will never know. As I said some time back, we ask for a heaven for ourselves where we will meet our loved ones. But do remember that if we are to have a heaven where we meet our loved ones, we'll also meet all those whom we dislike and who are our enemies. Because the Lord God may think that they were good chaps in their way and have them in heaven. Then what? You're going to have a fight up there again? No. It is this transforming. Don't cling to the shape, to the form. Attend completely now, and everything becomes wonderful and marvelous. This transmutation and the important part played by death. Death is not just a destroyer. Let death be. Death is the perfecter. Death perfects everything, brings everything. It acts when everything has come to fulfillment. Death is the final consummator. When everything, when life has, your life as it is now has come to its fulfillment, then comes that last act of transmutation, death, and lo and behold, this mysterious unknown magic of other life has come into being. So have no fear of death. Don't say no to death. Because death is life's immortal twin. Note carefully the words. I say death is life's immortal twin. It is the other face of life. And this other life is eternal life. Not for me as an entity, a separate entity. Because in eternity, there is no measurement. There is no particularity. There is no limitation. There is this divine mystery. Let the divine mystery be. Who am I to say, no, I want it otherwise? It is only I who suffer then, unnecessarily. So now, the religious life and the heart of religion, this realizing fulfillment and ultimate communion, complete communion with the total reality, this is the heart of religion, is it not? So, have we had in these four meetings in the afternoons some glimpse of this heart of religion, of the nature of the actual living of the holy life, here and now, free of desire, free of obtruding ourselves upon the world and spoiling it? Do we understand what it is to live like a pure flame of wisdom, of harmlessness and compassion, burning away every moment, and letting the eternity of the divine life shine with intense light? It is in our power not to let it do so. And this is where we sin. This is the fundamental wrong, the fundamental evil. Have we had some sort of glimpse of this or not? And if we can let the divine light shine through us, is not this the glory of God made manifest on earth? And you are the body, the holy body, the transubstantiated body, the human means by which the glory of God is made manifest throughout the world. You are that, yourself. So, we come round full circle in this fourth meeting with what we started at our first meeting. Happiness. You remember? I asked you the question, are you happy? Face your own soul and answer truly for your own selves. Are you happy? Perhaps if we have understood now the true meaning of happiness, what one can say is, enter your kingdom of happiness freely, silently, peacefully. Happiness is your birthright. And happiness is not the pursuit of desire and pleasure, of ambition, or any such thing. This happiness which I speak of was never born and it never dies. It is an eternal happiness, the bliss of God, which passes all understanding, just as the peace of God passes all understanding. Some of you have heard me say in the past, you are the children of the new dawn. But looking at the world as it is, with its lusts and hatreds, its fear and violence and stupidity, you may say, what dawn do I see? And if, by any chance, I see a gleam of heavenly light, it is soon swallowed in the tumultuous darkness of this world. And you might like to say to me, are you not just crying in the wilderness, this fearful wilderness of the world, with a vain hope? But listen, the light is within you. Let the light shine. That is our personal responsibility. Let the light shine. The light is not mine. The light is the divine light. Let it shine. And so you will realize your fulfillment as human beings. Consider for a moment. When you see the dawn rise, when you see the dawn and then see the sun rise, that dawn passes away because you are standing in the same place. But supposing you could move with that gleam of heavenly light, there would be a perpetual dawn and a perpetual glory of sunrise, wouldn't there? We are so bound by time and place, by our dull ideas, our petty beliefs, and by custom. Let the spirit soar into the infinity of the everlasting life. And then you will be the ever youthful, ever virginal child of the new dawn, which heralds the rising sun of your own transcendent light, of your own transcendent reality. And this is a way of approaching simply and with utter self-surrender and love the very heart of all religions.